This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is internationally celebrated pianist Andre Watts. Watts was a prodigy, famous by the time he was 16. Many prodigies never fulfill as adults the promise of their youth, but with the exception of a couple of bumpy years, Andre Watts has received sustained critical and popular acclaim for his playing. Andre Watts was born in Germany in 1946 to a Hungarian mother and a Black American GI father. The family moved to Philadelphia when Watts was 8. At age 16, Watts won an audition to perform as a soloist with Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic on a nationally telecast young people's concert. 3 weeks later, Bernstein called on Watts to perform at a regular subscription concert in place of Glenn Gould, who was ill. Watts' performance that night received international raves and brought him overnight fame. He's since recorded extensively and performed with the leading American and European orchestras. Andre Watts was taught his first piano lessons at age 6 by his mother. When we spoke, he recalled those early lessons.
There was not a lot of discipline involved, so it was just fun. And I'm, in retrospect, always very thankful about the way I started playing the piano, although it's the unconventional way, and, it makes all those, and I say this with no sarcasm, all those decent, hardworking, long-suffering piano teachers, it makes them shudder when I say that, I put the pedal down for a page at a time just to listen to all that sound building up, and rattled around a mile a minute playing everything but the right notes, and I did that for about a year.
People worry if you do that, you're going to develop bad habits that will be very difficult
yes.
to break.
It is true, of course, that then when I, this was all in Germany, and then when I came to the United States, when I came to Philadelphia, then my mother thought, well, it seems like he has some talent, so he should study with someone, and she got me to a piano teacher, and then I had to do scales and had to be told that, well, don't you think that's a lot of different sounds if you don't move your foot, off the pedal? And it took a little time, but what I got in that first year, I think, was the real complete hedonistic sort of unalloyed pleasure of playing the instrument, just sitting at the piano and running around with your fingers on it. And that has, in a way, never left me, and I'm very thankful.
Did it take a while before your teacher gave you music that you could play that you also really enjoyed as music?
No, because, when I came to Philadelphia when I was 8, and by the time I was sort of 8 and a half or almost 9, I had auditioned to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra with the Haydn Concerto. So certainly, within 1 or 2 months, she must have got me to start learning the Haydn Concerto, because I was no wizard as far as quick learning. I mean, I was quick study, but no genius. So it must have taken at least half a year to learn the piece. So I had right away challenge, and it wasn't boring drudgery exercises.
Obviously, when you were very young, a lot of people had the sense that you were an especially gifted pianist. Did you feel gifted or special when you were 9 at the time that you played with the orchestra?
Well, sure, I probably realized that this was something that I did well that the kids in my class didn't do. But, there were lots of other children who won at the same time that I did, and who did every year. There were other children who won and played at... I remember Linda Child played the same year that I played, and she was only 8 years old. I mean, so she was a year younger and probably played better, I mean, she seemed to be very poised. And there were all kinds of people around. I think that, uninhibited ability to perform of very young children, of course, if the child has no talent, it doesn't happen. There's no performing. But that uninhibitedness, if I can say that, masks a lot of other faults that will develop with the adult and prevent a career or prevent continuing to play in front of the public.
It's funny that you should say uninhibited way that children perform, because a lot of children were very traumatized by having to get on stage and perform when they were young, either for talent shows or in school or whatever. Or even at family reunions when their mother would say, play them Brahms, dear. They're all here to
but,
see us
it's
today.
Interesting that you're saying that. Do you think, I don't know if we should get into this discussion, but do you think they're traumatized by the actual act of being a trained SEAL by the act of it, or are they traumatized by all the stuff that that entails vis-a-vis the parent, the teacher, and all that stuff? Isn't that what the hassle is?
Yeah, I think the hassle isn't the playing at the beck and call of the adult.
And being called out,
being an object
roll
that you
over
show
and
off.
Play
yes, that's right. Well, did anything like that ever happen to you? I mean,
no.
Did you ever feel like a showpiece for somebody else?
No. I was, again, fortunate because my mother certainly was never, in any stretch of the imagination, a stage mother. She didn't like the idea of, she didn't think it was good to have young children performing a lot. When I lived here when I was about 10 years old, there was a television show called The Children's Hour, I think. It was called The Children's Hour, yeah. And they called my mother. I'd played with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and they said, we'd like to have him on the show, as a regular. They had wonderfully talented kids, I probably might have gotten lost anyway because the kids were talented in that kind of really fast, spur-of-the-moment kind of great gift way. But they wanted me to play every Sunday in short piece, and they would pay you $25 per Sunday, which was a ton of money for us at that time. And my mother said, yeah, well, that's very nice, but I don't think so. And then she would talk to me and my teacher at that time and said, well, yeah, but the problem is he'll have to spend all week learning that little piece, and he'll be doing that for weeks and weeks, and he won't learn any real music. So I was spared all that kind of... That's why I never felt in the prodigy mold, really, in the real sense, exploited prodigy.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I was speaking with Andre Watts, if you're just joining us. By the time you were 16, you played with the New York Philharmonic for the Young People's Concert.
Yes.
What were the auditions like for that? Who actually did the audition?
Well, the first part of the audition, the listeners, the judges, were the three assistant conductors to Bernstein at that time, and Helen Coates, who was, I think, Bernstein's first piano teacher and longtime secretary, confidant, everything, I mean, she was a real sort of one of the pillars of his existence. And these four people listened to the preliminaries. I felt rather comfortable playing the... I thought in very generalized terms about the difficulty and the dangers and I hope I do okay and stuff like that. I was also a little dazed at that time because 3 weeks previously I had gone for an audition where I played, I thought, really well and didn't make it to the finals. I didn't get past the first round. And so at this preliminary for the Young Peoples, when those three men and that woman stood up after I finished playing, I remember being sort of thinking, yeah, that must be good, right? That means they liked it. So I made it past this round. It didn't really register. I wasn't immediately puffed up with pride and thinking, hey, I really played well. They loved it. I was sort of dazed. And that was also lucky. I didn't come out of that daze for a while. It wasn't a stupor, didn't make me stupid, but it made me focus only on playing the music rather than, hey, this is important. I mean, this means something in your existence. It means something in your life. If you ruin this and you may not, be able to get a career. I didn't have time for all that. I was just worrying about the piece.
After you won that audition and got to play for the Young People's Concert, and then you sat in for the ailing Glenn Gould a few days after that with the New York Philharmonic, did you start thinking at that point, well, I've made it this far, I can either keep going or I can do something terrible here and fail? Did you feel the incredible pressure that was on you then?
Yeah, not till those concerts were over, and not until maybe 2 or 3 months later. I felt the pressure very strongly. You see, I played the two subscription concerts in place of Glenn Gould. And there was all this hoopla and all this newspaper stuff and managers coming and saying, ready to manage you and record companies and, the whole business. And that was it was interesting. It was not a real problem. But that summer, I played a concert at Lewisohn Stadium and then I had to play three concerts on tour with the Philharmonic. So these were my first sort of out there professional concerts. And then I felt the pressure. And of course, I was very young. Yes, I was 16. My birthday's in June, so that summer for that tour, I think maybe I had just turned 17. And I was in a stage where I would sit up all night, waiting for the newspapers to come out. I would watch television until it went off, which it did do in those days, you know, and then read something and then run out and get the newspapers. And, you know, the whole idea that you go someplace and play a concert and somebody wants to do an interview with you before you've played was already strange and unusual. And I learned very quickly, you know, I would do an interview and my mother traveled with me and, you know, somebody would be very pleasant and I would be very open and free and I would talk about it. And then that part would be fine. That would all be accurately reflected in the interview when I would read it. But then there would be these things about, well, whether this is just a flash in the pan in this career. And I would think, what do they mean? Oh, yeah, I guess, sure, I guess. You know, and then it began to dawn on me, uh-oh, you know, how many bad concerts can I play? Not intentionally, but, you know, before they, you know, cut my head off and, you know, pitch it away and say, let's not hear from this one again. It didn't last very long for me, that worrying about that, I must say.
What brought you out of it?
A number of things I think would be difficult for me to pinpoint. I really believe that at a certain point, early on, I realized that you could have a great success even if you played like a pig, and you could play what you felt was truly beautifully and make no impact on people. And so I thought, well, you know, hope for the best and just try to play well, and that's it.
So at that point, you stopped using other people's reactions as your gauge of how well you were playing?
Yeah, I began slowly to read reviews differently. I mean, they would still have a big impact on me. I remember, you see, so let's see, I played two concerts to substitute for Gould, right? Then I played at Lewiston Stadium. The next concert was at the Hollywood Bowl. And this was a tour of Bernstein's with the Philharmonic, but Seiji Ozawa was conducting my portion of the concert. So it was Seiji and me, we were this little couple out there, you know, doing this Liszt concerto, and the big New York Philharmonic with Bernstein did the rest of the program. And I stayed up all night, ran down on the street, I stayed at a hotel in Beverly Hills, ran down on the street in the morning, got a newspaper, and you know those little subheadings in newspapers, you know, slightly bigger print, you know, short headline. Well, this one was long. This was a subheading, but it was a lot of words in it. And the first part of the review was about the New York Philharmonic and Bernstein, and then there was a subheading, and it said, Watts's melodic line withers on the vine. And I just turned 17, and I want to tell you, boy, was this pain, agony, you know, and a lot of suffering. But I joke about it now. I talk about it a lot because maybe it was good, in a way, to get such a... That obviously was not meant as a constructive criticism, for God's sake. I mean, you know, you got some 17-year-old kid who's starting his career and you want to do a hatchet job on him. That can hardly be viewed as constructive. You could say that he let the melodic line die, sag, and that he needs to learn how to sustain, if that's the case, which I didn't think was the case either, frankly. I didn't agree with the comment, aside from the fact that I thought it was vicious. And that made me then... It gave me a lot of grief, but I would think about things, and I would think, well, now, wait a minute. How, if someone is so ill-disposed, how much faith should you put actually in their musical judgment? How objective are they? I mean, do they really know what they're saying? And that got me over that sort of quickly. I must say, though, I have learned from colleagues older and wiser that one should not read reviews before eating breakfast. And I do tend to avoid it. I really do, even to this day.
Your mother's white and your father was black.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know if you felt between two different worlds when you were growing up.
Precisely. But actually, I've never been asked that question that way. People usually assume and ask with the assumption in the question that you either felt part of the white community or part of the black community. And they're always a little bit surprised when I go through my palaver, which has developed into a set spiel over the years, but I mean it sincerely, and I'm happy about it in a certain sense, that the reason that I feel comfortable about throwing stones at any and all races is precisely because, well, I am half black and half white. That is simply a fact. But when I was growing up, because of skin color, I didn't belong to the white world. And because it was, you know, in the neighborhood rather clear that my mother was white, I didn't belong to the black world. So I was some bizarre case. I mean, obviously, there are other cases, you know. It's not isolated in the world. But it was different. And that, I mean, it didn't cause me necessarily a lot of grief, but there certainly wasn't a sense of identity resulting from belonging to a group. That not. And I kind of like it.
When you became of age and started entering the performance world and everything, did anyone ever say to you, well, say, you're part black, shouldn't you be playing jazz?
Oh, all the time.
Yes. What would you say to that?
Well, first I laugh because, I mean, and for a variety of reasons I laugh. It's probably funny. Perhaps I laugh out of embarrassment for the other person, not for myself. I really don't know what to say to you because I've heard it so much over the years now. Because, you know, when I play, I have a lot of body mannerisms. And my mouth moves and sometimes I sing, unfortunately, and I stamp my feet and stuff like that. And so sometimes people don't even ask. You know, they come backstage and they say, oh, well, we watched you and, boy, you must really play great jazz. And I just sort of say, no, I don't. I mean, when I was much younger, I probably said it apologetically, you know, because I felt like I ought to. I don't mind. I wish people wouldn't assume that that's the case. If they ask, I find it less of a racially oriented pigeonholing assumption than if they assume. It's when they assume, you know, I always have the urge. I mean, and really not with much anger. I mean, it's more funny. The urge to say, you want to watch me tap dance? You know, I mean, you know, it's sort of, I can understand it, of course. You don't really expect, the world is not really accustomed to having brown-skinned people playing, sitting at a piano playing Mozart and Beethoven and Haydn and stuff like that. It makes sense, you know, it's usually those people who are, you know, playing the blues and jazz and stuff like that. I think that's fine. That's great. But if indeed your senses show you a brown-skinned person playing Mozart, Schubert, and Beethoven, I'm not so sure you should automatically assume, well, he also must, you know, be a successor to Art Tatum. I'd love to be a successor to Art Tatum. Unfortunately, that's not one of my talents.
When you began to be successful in the classical music world, did you become an important symbol to black audiences?
I don't know. I gotta ask black audiences. I mean, I like the idea of the role model business. Beyond that, I don't know. I was never very much of an activist. I also have never been. I'm probably even perverse and will bend over backwards to resist automatically being for something because it's either white or black. If I get a hint of that smell of that kind of a thing, I probably will react against it even before I really know the complete facts, just because I dislike the idea that, well, you should be approving of this because it is black oriented. Why? That's something I never accept. Or, I mean, it's as silly to me, frankly, as if somebody said, well, you shouldn't be making any criticisms of that because it's Hungarian and your mother's Hungarian. So it's her problem, not mine. You know, I don't have to. So I feel sort of strongly about hitting out on that.
My guest is Andre Watts. Has having a career as a soloist turned out to be anything like what you thought it was going to be, traveling around the world all the time?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. It's a great question, because when you talk to music students who want careers, if you tell them about the negatives, even if you talk to adults who are not in the music business, and you tell them about the negatives, they generally think you're being very witty and humorous and charming and humble and et cetera, et cetera. They don't believe that there are a lot of, not unhappy, miserable, but simply mundane, pedestrian, run-of-the-mill, wearing down kinds of everyday stuff that has to be done, and that sort of, you know, you get the feeling when you're low that all these things are conspiring to rob you of your soul, you know. Especially when I talk to women's committees around the country, you know, you play with an orchestra and you, the women committees luncheons, because these ladies do a lot of support and they have their luncheons and you go as the guest in the town with the orchestra to speak. And I say to them, you know, getting your laundry done is one of the priorities. They all laugh. They all think that's funny. Well, sure, it might be funny, but it's true. I mean, you go through your schedule, you know, the idea is you're supposed to be thinking about, you know, the conventional idea is that you're thinking about the inner meaning of the slow movement of Schubert A major 120, and what do you really do when you get to that F sharp, which is the first time you've played the F sharp in the movement, and actually what you're figuring out is, let's see, it's Friday, and it's 8:30 in the morning on Friday. I got to play tonight, I have to play tomorrow night, I have to play Sunday afternoon, Monday is empty, but Monday's a travel day, and I have to play Tuesday night. So I've got three sets of tails. Have I been in this, I'm making you a scenario, you know, have I been in this hotel before, and do I know what time the laundry comes back? Will it come back in time for me to get to the hall for the concert? And it goes on, you know, and that's sort of, those things are, that you don't think about when you're little. And somebody says, wow, you know, you could spend your life, you could be rich and famous, and all you'd have to do is just play the piano, which is what you say you want to do, right? That's all you want to do? Great. You can do this for the rest of your life. with those exceptions, with, you know, I'm not finding the right words, you know, the kinds of things that people always talk about, the everyday wearing down, the little drip, 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 drip of life, you know. With the exception of that, it's pretty much the, what I thought it would be. It's more difficult, in a way, for the creative aspect. Well, you know, when I was younger, I just didn't think that... I always thought that there would be an end to what you had to do to a specific piece. I figured, you know, well, one of these days I will know how to play the Chopin G minor ballade, and that'll be over. Well, it's never over. It's the real Sisyphus, you know. You push the rock up, and you think, hey, this is dandy, whoops, you know, down it goes. Which is nice. There is a beauty to that, and in a way it is possibly the most beautiful, that it's literally almost impossible to be bored, because the more you know about a piece of music, in other words, the more you understand about the piece of music, the more you understand how much more there is to be understood. And that's sometimes frustrating, of course, if you're, you know, you got to play the piece in 2 hours and you have a great insight and you realize, oh, and I haven't now incorporated all that. But basically, it's it really is very, very wonderful. It's something I don't talk about very much. It's hard to articulate because it is very special.
Do you think your playing's changed a lot over the years?
Yes and no. I've said this so often, but I don't know what else to say. My feelings are always the same when I'm asked this question. I once had a conversation with George Schandor, pianist, and he said, well, look, what really happens is that you learn more and you get more sophisticated and your equipment gets better, but in principle there's a core that you play now exactly the way you did when you were 9 years old. And I believe him. I think he's right. There is a core that doesn't change. The funny, intimate, real, At the core, at the soul of your being, the funny little predilections remain. You know, that whole business about when you play a piece basically is, and these are generalizations, I understand that, but basically is your thrust for the making of the piece in an interior way. In other words, you almost project the piece back inside towards yourself, almost as if you're hiding it from any other listeners. Is that your basic leaning? You know, we're not talking about personality types, actually, is what we're doing, and it gets reflected in the music. Or is your basic leaning that, wow, you figured out how this piece goes and you play it and you kind of want it to blossom out? I mean, it's like handing somebody a bouquet and saying, hey, you want to smell this? You know, those things I don't think change.
Do you think of yourself as being an extroverted or an introverted player?
As a player?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, extrovert. Oh, yes. Yes, without question.
You've played with orchestras around the world. Do they seem remarkably similar or remarkably different when you stack them all up?
This may be sort of a cheap answer. Maybe I'm getting, you know, mentally lazy. I don't mean it to be that way. It's like people. You know, basically, you know, I mean, there's a head here and, you know, then come the shoulders. No, I mean that, you know. But then God knows what it, you know, you can go from a monster to an angel. That's how I feel about orchestras. There are these basic things, and then suddenly you go from one place to another and you have this, you get a feeling of the collective. You get a generalized feeling from these people that they couldn't care less what you're playing in one town. And even if it's a piece that has constant back and forth, where, you know, constant echoes of the same tune, and in the rehearsals you lean in there and you hear them playing sort of, you know, rum bum bum, and maybe you want to play differently and you lean and you go bum bum bum, and every time they repeat it they go back and the third one is soft, and you make it, you exaggerate yours, and they don't care. And another place you go and you've not quite done it the first time very successfully, and they return it to you already having figured out what it is you believe, and they're willing to play, really to make music with you. So that's, it's all kinds of varieties in that sense. And it has, again, to do with attitude, personality.
That was pianist Andre Watts, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical director for today's show was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGorin and co-produced by Danny Miller and me. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.